outside the Sanskritization, we've got the transformation of the ascetic ideal and its assimilation into high caste household ideology, as in the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita bears witness to this process of the assimilation of the ascetic ideal into a householder ideology. So you don't have to drop out, you don't have to become an ascetic, but renunciation becomes an internal practice that the householder can do do yourself. So on the one, okay, the ascetic ideal gets assimilated into high caste householder ideology, as we've witnessed to in the Bhagavad Gita. And conversely, it gets assimilated into lower level possession cults, as we'll see in a couple of weeks. Ascetic ideas and ascetic terminology becomes absorbed at that lower level in the low caste possession cults. Now, between these extremes, we've got highly revered renouncer groups such as the Dashanamis, who were said to be founded by Shankara, but were in fact founded much later in the 15th or 16th century, as has been shown by a fellow in Soas, whose name I forget now. Okay, so you've got Sanskritization or Brahmanization, you've got this growth of the Sanskrit cosmopolis, you've got the assimilation of ascetic ideals into householder ideology, and you've got the segmentary state. You don't emerging after the Gupta period, after about 500 or 600 AD. Now, so the segmentary state means that the kingdoms of South Asia were not like sort of the Roman Empire or something like that, but were embedded hierarchies. So you had a chief or of a local region would pay homage to a larger chief. So you've got A, B, and C. You've got three small regional kingdoms, and they would pay ritual homage and pay taxes to a larger area, who in turn would pay homage to a larger regional king. So you get this embedded hierarchy, inside your embedded hierarchy. So you have a king who establishes a political centre, and his power, as it were, radiates out from there, but not as a centralised state organism, but more as one of these embedded hierarchies in which local chieftains, as it were, pay ritual homage and pay taxes to the one above, who in turn pays homage to the king above that. So it's a kind of empire, but not an empire in the sense of the Roman Empire or Alexander's Empire or something, or perhaps like Alexander's Empire, I'm not sure. So it's to do with patronage, this embedded hierarchy of power. And these kings were particularly important because they patronized groups of Brahmins and gave them land, particularly important, the giving of land to Brahmins. And this giving of land to Brahmins and the patronage of Brahmins is tied in, linked together with the promotion of certain kinds of religion, certain kinds of devotion to particular deities. So you've got political patronage of various sects, if you like, of various Brahmanical groups. And you've also got the development of narrative traditions which cut across political divides. Now, there's no surviving historiography in South Asia, with a few exceptions, such as the Raja Tarangini in Kashmir and the Vamsha literature in Sri Lanka. So there's no surviving historiography of the kind that developed in the Greek, Arabic and European traditions. Now, it could be there, but it's simply been eradicated. That's a possibility, that it wasn't preserved. So we don't know about it because it's died out. But its absence makes the dating of Sanskrit texts difficult and has reinforced a tendency to construct India in the West as ahistorical, mythical and irrational or mystical, in contrast to the West, seen as historical, scientific and rational. And this construction of India as the West's irrational other has tended to hide strongly rationalist dimensions within the history of Indic culture, such as the science of ritual, grammar, architecture, maths, logic and philosophy. But having said that, there are nevertheless strong narrative and mythological dimensions within Indian culture, in which there's no clear distinction between history, hagiography and mythology. They tend to merge together in these narrative traditions. Now, particularly, there are two important groups of narrative traditions embodied in oral and written texts, namely the two epics, the Ramayana and Mahabharata, and the Puranas, collectively known as Itihasa Purana. And these texts were the concern, and in these texts we see the concerns of political life at court, concerns of Brahmins and ordinary people, along with descriptions of ritual and mythology. And the texts chart the rise of the great theistic traditions of India, focused on the gods Vishnu, Shiva, and Devi, the goddess. Now, although the epics transcend particular cultic affiliation, there is nevertheless a case for saying that they are the epics are Vaishnava in orientation, as are many of the Puranas. And it's worth bearing in mind that the epics continue to hold sway over popular imagination and have in the recent past been used in a nationalist politicisation of Hinduism. So the epics, the two great epics, are extremely important, not only historically, but in contemporary understandings of Hinduism, like contemporary political Hinduism. Now, the Puranas, in contrast to the epics, the Puranas, which are called the Puranas, the ancient stories, the stories of the ancient past, are a vast body of complex narratives which contain genealogies of deities and kings up to the Guptas, and cosmologies, law codes, descriptions of ritual and accounts of pilgrimage centres. So they do provide some notion of coherence to the South Asian continent in some ways through the idea of pilgrimage. The bulk of the material contained in the Puranas was established during the Gupta reign, although amendments were made to the text into medieval times, and traditionally they dealt with five topics: the creation or emanation of the universe, the destruction or reabsorption of the universe, genealogies of kings and deities, the reigns of the 14 Manus, and the history of the solar and lunar dynasties. And Chris Minkowski has been speaking about that last time, and I think he'll carry on talking about that on Friday. Now, who composed these? The texts arose within the milieu of what's called the smarter Brahmins. The smarter Brahmins were those who followed the Smritis. Particularly the Puranic, and Puranic religion became known as smarta or Pauranika, those who followed the Puranas. And these smartas were particularly concerned with the domestic worship of five deities in five shrines, the Panchayatana Puja, namely Vishnu, Shiva, Ganesh, Surya and Devi. But later you get worship of distinct deities, and that these distinct deities come to the fore. So later Puranas are concerned with particular deities like Shiva, Vishnu, Skanda, or whoever. But earlier Puranas tend to be more... deities have been sort of more equally important in the earlier material. Now, we must understand then the development of these texts in the political atmosphere of the collapse of the Guptas and the rise of independent kingdoms. In the 7th century, these kingdoms were the Chalukyas in the central and western Deccan, the Pallavas in the southeast, and from about 900 to 1200, these kingdoms were replaced by the Pandyas in the far south, the Cholas, particularly important in the Tamil region, and the Rashtrakutas replacing the Chalukyas. There's a good book by Kulka, history, a short history of India, something like, I can't remember the precise title, but you can read all about these different dynasties and so on, which is terribly complex, and one forgets the details in that Kulka book, which I think is extremely good. And each of these kingdoms developed urban centres. So, and these cities became the centres of those kingdoms, but not only centres of administration and commerce, but ritual centres with a temple at the hub of the town and the streets radiating out from the central hub where the temple is. And the authority of the king was established through his Brahmanical legitimization in the temple. And from the 11th to 13th centuries, large temple complexes were built as centres of the regional kingdoms, such as Jagannath in Puri, the Nataraja temple at Chidambaram, the Raja Rajeshwara temple in Tanjavur, and others. And of particular importance are the gods Vishnu, Shiva and Devi, all of whom have their own Puranas, and all were established in important temples which were linked to particular kingdoms. So that's a broad sort of context in which these early traditions arise. And I want this week to focus on Shiva and move on to the goddess and Vishnu next week. So the Shaiva traditions then. Let's have a look at these Shaiva traditions as examples of the development of these theistic traditions. Now, okay, a Brahmin householder who worships Shiva with puja, using Vedic mantras and making offerings to orthodox forms of Shiva, particularly the Shiva Linga, was within the sphere of orthodox practice of Varnashrama Dharma. And such a follower of Shiva was called a Maheshvara, who followed the Puranic worship of Shiva. And the Maheshvara can be contrasted with the Shaiva initiate, who was technically called a Shaiva. So you've got this distinction between Maheshvaras and Shaivas. Maheshvaras followed the Puranic, smarter religion of Shivaism, and the Shaivas followed a Shaiva sect, as it were, into which they were initiated, such as the Pashupatas or the Shaiva Siddhanta, which I'll be speaking about presently. So a Maheshvara at death would go to the heaven of Shiva at the top of the world egg. So in the Puranic cosmology, the cosmos is like an egg with different levels in it. And the Shiva Loka is at the top. So at death, if this is the world, a Maheshvara would go to be with Shiva in the Shiva Loka. So it's a bit like Vaikuntha, it's the equivalent of Vaikuntha, the Shaiva equivalent of Vaikuntha. So a Vaishnava will go to Vishnu, one of the lokas of Vishnu. So a Shaiva, Maheshvara rather, would go at death to the top of the world egg. Whereas a Shaiva, an initiate into a particular sect of Shivaism, believed that their goal was liberation, which was beyond the Shiva Loka, which was somehow transcended the Shiva Loka. So a Shaiva, by contrast, followed the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana, as a Buddha or a Bauddha would follow the Buddha Shasana, the teachings of the Buddha. So a Shaiva would follow the Shiva Shasana, the teachings of Shiva. And this Shiva Shasana, the teachings of Shiva, are contained in the Shastra, in the Shaiva scriptures, namely the Tantras. And many Shaivas revered these groups of texts called Tantra or Agama, that which has come down to us, the Agama. Now the Tantra, the word Tantra denotes a text or a system of ritual and a teaching. And there are generally a vast body of texts in Sanskrit composed from about the 8th century onwards, perhaps that's a little early, but the 8th century onwards. And the term Tantra denotes not only the text, but the system of ritual that the texts contain and the teaching the texts contain. And there are Tantras of Vishnu, i.e. the Pancharatra Sanghitas, there are tantras of Shiva, tantras of the goddess, and tantras of the sun, all of which are lost. And there are also Jain tantras and Buddhist tantras. And the Buddhist tantras form the basis of the Vajrayana, the Tibetan kind of Buddhism. And the Buddhist tantras are derived from Shaiva prototypes, as Alexis Sanderson shows. And each of these traditions believe their texts to be revealed by Vishnu or Shiva, etc. And these texts were the fulfillment or culmination of Vedic revelation, as the Vajrayana in Buddhism considered itself to be the fulfillment of the Mahayana, so the tantric traditions regarded themselves as the fulfillment of the Vedic tradition. Now, some tantras and tantric traditions are notorious for their antinomian and erotic elements, ritual sex, meat and alcohol offerings to ferocious deities. But these topics are restricted only to some texts of the extreme Kaula groups. But most contain a wealth of material on ritual cosmology, the building of temples, architecture, and correct conduct. Most of the tantric texts regard themselves as being extensions or fulfillments of the Vedic tradition, and not in contrast to it. Now, these antinomian tantras later became known as left-hand tantras. So what are these texts about? They're concerned with practice, or sadhana, in order to gain liberation. And to do that, you have to be initiated, so they're concerned with initiation in order to gain liberation. And power. Power is important in these texts. The idea of magical power, siddhi, and pleasure in higher worlds, bhogar or bhukti. So there's a common ritual structure in the daily rites. Having got initiated, there are two kinds of initiation. There's the ordinary initiation, the samaya diksha, and the liberatory initiation, the nirvana diksha. So the samaya diksha, you have access to certain texts of the tradition, in the Shaiva tradition anyway. You can read the text having got initiated into this particular tantra. And then that's followed by the nirvana diksha, which ensures your liberation within 7 lifetimes, or it depends on the text, but the Malini Vijayotra Tantra says that if you're initiated into it, you get liberated within 7 lifetimes. So you have initiation, which is important. To become a Shaiva, you have to get initiated. And then there's this common ritual structure of daily rites that you follow for the rest of your life. So the purification of the body, something called the Bhuta Shuddhi, the creation of a divine body in the imagination through mantra, internal worship or visualization, and external worship or puja, which involves the use of various hand gestures or mudra and ritual diagrams. So each day then, the Shaiva Brahmin, who's initiated into the Shaiva tradition, would purify the body through identifying the body with the cosmos and symbolically absorbing the cosmos within the body, and destroying the gross body, symbolically destroying the gross body. So in your imagination, you'd imagine a fire burning up from the toe of the right foot and consuming the body to a pile of ashes, and then a flood of water coming along and washing it away. And then in your imagination, you'd recreate your body as divine through imposing mantras upon it, touching parts of the body and repeating certain mantras. This is called nyasa. Because only a god can worship a god in these systems. So you have to become divine to worship the deity. So you become divine through the nyasa, and then you worship the Lord internally in your imagination, and then externally offering flowers and incense to a solid icon of the deity in the shrine. And that's the practice that you would do. And at death, you would go to liberation, in the Shaiva Siddhanta anyway. Or within a few lifetimes anyway. Okay, so there's a ritual initiation is important, daily rites and occasional rites for a desired goal. And also funerals and birth rites and so on. So it's a whole life system is presented in the tantric material. The shared ritual structure, there's also elaborate cosmology in which the tantric cosmologies are added on to the Vedic cosmology. So the tantras come along and say, oh yes, well the Vedic cosmology is all very well, but actually we know more than that, and we add these other extra layers. And then you get other tantras that say, actually we know more than that lot over there, and then you get these layers upon layers added in these very complex hierarchies of worlds. Now the Shaiva Siddhanta, moving on to the Shaiva Siddhanta. Oh, another concern is among some tantras is possession and exorcism, which indicates their low caste origins. Texts such as the Sharma Shiva Guru Deva Padati, the Nature Tantra, are concerned with what you do if you get possessed by a supernatural being that causes illness, for example, illness in your children or something, how you get rid of these beings. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta is the main tantric tradition, as it were, which provides the basic ritual structure, the doctrinal system of what's called the path of mantras. So, there's an excellent article by Sanderson called The Shaiva and Tantric Traditions, in which he outlines some of these developments. So you've got worship of Shiva, you've got Puranic worship of Shiva, which is the Puranas, which is orthodox, in line with Vedic orthodoxy, or orthopraxy. And then you've got the path of mantras, the mantra marga. Then you've got the you've got the Puranic worship of Shiva, then you've got the non-Puranic worship of Shiva. Amongst these are something called the higher path, the Ati Marga. The Ati Marga are groups called the Pashupatas. Now the Pashupata ascetics were particularly important in medieval India because they owned lots of temples and had a lot of influence. So Somnath in the west of India was owned by Pashupatas until it was sacked by Marud of Ghazni in the 11th century, about 1020 or something, I can't remember the dates. Ravila Tapal's wrote an interesting book on that. So the Pashupata ascetics, they were ascetics who regarded themselves as orthodox and who had the higher path, the Ati Marga, or the outer path. And they covered themselves in ashes, but were nevertheless ascetics. Were nevertheless in line with the Vedas. And they regarded that their Ati Marga, their higher path, was the fifth ashrama. Do you remember the ashramas? The stages of life that you go through, student stage, householder stage, hermit, renouncer. Well, the Pashupatas thought that their higher path was the fifth ashrama, the fifth stage beyond that. And they had a practice of hanging about the temple, living in the temple, and eventually becoming a complete ascetic and withdrawing from the world, dying, really, scavenging, eating what you can. And withdrawing from life and withdrawing from the world in order to achieve liberation with Shiva. Cover themselves in the ashes of cow dung, but not cremation ground, ascetics, not cremation ground ashes. They were pure ascetics. And they didn't want to be polluted by death. The other path was elantra marga, path of elantras. Now this group of texts, if you like, was divided into two main sections: the Shaiva, the tantras, or the Shaiva Siddhanta, and the non-Siddhanta groups. And the non-Siddhanta groups are sometimes called Kashmir Shaivism. So you've got orthodox renouncers hanging out in temples with royal patronage, very powerful Pashupatas, some of whom become extreme renouncers. And you've got another group of texts called the Mantra Marga, whose adherents, the Shaiva Siddhanta, are also very powerful. But these groups, the Shaiva Siddhanta, includes householders. Is this terribly confusing, or is it becoming clear? You've got, let's start again. You've got worship of Shiva. You've got orthodox worship of Shiva in the Puranas, and you've got non-orthodox worship of Shiva, non-Puranic worship of Shiva. The non-Puranic worship of Shiva is subdivided into these two broad groups called the higher path and the path of mantras. The higher path actually comprises one important group called the Pashupatas, who were ascetics who had a lot of land and owned a lot of temples and were politically important, and who sought liberation in due course from the cycle of rebirth. The other path, the other group, was the Mantra Marga, whose followers were called the Shaiva Siddhantins, who were householders but also owned temples. And they're particularly important in the south and in Kashmir. So the Shaiva Siddhanta still carries on down into the present day. It still exists today. Pashupatas kind of died out. But the Shaiva Siddhanta is still a living tradition. And it's house Brahmin, high caste Brahmin, Brahmin householders who are initiated into their group of texts. And then you've got another group, the non-Siddhanta group, particularly in Kashmir, sometimes called Kashmir Shaivism, but that's a bit of a misnomer, as Alexis shows. So it's the Shaiva Siddhanta that I want to talk about today. Now, and the Shaiva Siddhanta then provides the basic ritual and doctrinal system of the path of mantras. And it originated in Kashmir, and then it went south into Tamil Nadu. It became where Tamil Bhakti became absorbed into it, where devotional aspect of the religion, devotion to Shiva became absorbed into it. So originally it wasn't devotional, but became devotional. The Nayanmars and the Tirumurai, which contains poetry and forms the Shaiva canon along with the Tantras, which was developed between the 6th and 12th centuries. So the theology of the Shaiva Siddhanta, it assumes the revelation of the Veda. First of all, the Veda is, sure, the Veda is revelation. But the tradition says our texts, our Tantras, transcend the revelation of the Veda. It's a further revelation from Shiva, from God, from Shiva. The Vedas were for people who of lesser intelligence, whose intellects were not sharp, whereas the Shaiva revelation is for those of higher intelligence, who can understand, who have a higher level of understanding. Also, that the revelation of Shiva is a dualistic revelation, which means that the tantras of Shiva, according to this group, are dualistic, which means that there's a distinction between three eternal realities. Although they're called dualistic, it's actually more than pluralistic, really. There's three eternal realities: God, self, and world. And they're ontologically distinct from each other, and have no beginning and will have no end, although the individual soul can become liberated. And these three realities, it called... Oh, I didn't have it... Oh, yeah, Patti. Lord, the Lord is Patti. Parsha is the bond, or Shakti, or the universe which binds it, and the beast is Pashu, cow is the soul. So Pashupati is the lord of the beasts, or the lord of the cattle. So the Pashu is the soul, which is the beast, which is bound by the noose of the universe. And Pashupati is the shepherd, in a way, the lord who guides the Pasha, the Pashu. There are important theologians in this tradition in the 9th, 10th centuries. Ramakanta is one important one who you may have heard of. Sadyujata, Agorashiva, Bhojaraja. I won't go into their particular theologies. And a text that you'll have access to that you could read if you're interested is a Kiranakantra, the Tantra of the Ray Tantra, Sun Ray Tantra. And that contains the doctrines of the three realities. And that's been translated by Dominic Goodall with an interesting introduction as well, along with Ramakanta's commentary. So if you're interested in this theology, you can read that text. Okay, so you've got these three realities. The soul is bound up with in the universe, and the goal of life is liberation from it through initiation into the tantric tradition, followed by daily rites that you perform for the rest of your life. And this is also linked with a tattva hierarchy. There's the universe for the Shaiva Siddhantins is a hierarchy of levels. On the second handout, you've got a list of the tattvas. The tattvas... Have you got one?
No.
Are there any more down there?
No.
Some coming up. The tattvas are levels of the universe, or categories. There's various translations. Principle, category, essence, reality... And it's this idea that the universe is a hierarchy, that the world, this world we experience is but one world, and there are other invisible worlds that we can't see, which are sort of higher, as it were, than this world. And so the journey back to Shiva is a journey back through the universe, back through the cosmic hierarchy. Now, many years before this, there was a system of philosophy called Samkhya in India, which was a dualist philosophy which maintained there are two realities in the universe, the soul and matter, and the soul is bound up or entangled in matter, and the goal of life is to separate the soul from matter. Now, matter in that tradition was divided into various subgroups or tattvas. So matter or prakriti emanates the universe that we experience. So it emanates the mind, which the Samkhya is divided into intellect or higher mind, buddhi, the ego or the self, ahankara, and manas, another word for the mind, which has which is like one of the senses. And then you get it analyzed the world into the organs of hearing, organs of cognition, organs of action, subtle elements and gross elements. So subjectivity and objectivity both emanate out of prakriti, as it were, for the Samkhya system. So the subject of first person predicates, I go to the supermarket, I perform the sacrifice, are not the subject of, are not the not the true self. The true self is deeper than that, which is the Purusha, or the person, or the self. Now that Samkhya system becomes absorbed by the Shaiva Siddhanta into this hierarchy of tattvas. So they add their own 11 categories to the Samkhya ones. So they say, okay, Samkhya is all very well, but actually we understand more than the Samkhya. we understand there are 11 further categories to the Samkhya 24. And these are the 11 that they add on there. So they divide the universe into these two broad groups, the pure creation and the impure creation. Sometimes that's called the mixed creation, the middle, from Maya to Purusha. And from Prakriti to Earth is sometimes called the impure creation. But okay, so you've generally got these two broad groups. So Shiva, in Shiva's essence, at the very top of the universe, Shiva emanates or manifests the first level, which is the level of Shiva, the Shiva Tattva. After the Shiva Tattva emerges Shakti, the Shakti Tattva, and then emerges Sadar Shiva, and so on, right the way through. So this is the Shaiva system. Each of these tattvas then corresponds to different worlds. And you get 224 worlds in the Shaiva system. But there are actually many more than that. So each of the tantras will have a section, well not all the tantras, but many of the tantras will have a section called on the bhuvanas, on the different worlds that exist in the different levels of the cosmos. And you can do a sort of archaeology of the text through the later texts will add more worlds to the earlier texts to show how they've transcended the earlier text, and they've actually got more worlds in them than the earlier material. So the goal of life is to ascend up through the hierarchy back to Shiva, as it were. Or in fact, really, to step off of the hierarchy altogether and to merge with them, and to become, for the Shaiva Siddhanta, become liberated. Now, liberation for the Shaiva Siddhanta didn't mean merging with Shiva, but it meant realizing that you were like Shiva, Shiva Tulya, equal to Shiva. So Shiva Tulya doesn't mean merging with Shiva, but it means becoming like Shiva. And the only difference between you and Shiva is that Shiva performs the five actions of creation, maintenance, destruction, revealing himself and concealing himself. So once you're liberated, you're equal to Shiva, the difference being that Shiva was never trapped in matter, and the difference being that Shiva performs the five acts. But apart from that, you're equal to Shiva, although numerically distinct. If that makes any sense. All Shivas, all souls are identical, but they are numerically distinct from each other and distinct from Shiva. Now you get another group of traditions called the non-Siddhantika traditions, which reject the Shaiva Siddhanta understanding of this system. And they are monistic systems. It's called Kashmir Shaivism, and I don't think I'll go into it this time. But broadly, that they say that there's only one being in the universe, which is Shiva, who is identified with consciousness, and these tattvas are not real, they're emanations of consciousness. So when you get liberated, you actually recognize your identity with Shiva, with that consciousness. So they reject the Shaiva Siddhanta dualistic interpretation of the texts and life in general. Now, the Shaiva Siddhanta then is an example of a devotion of a theistic tradition, which originates as a knowledge-based system, but becomes devotional in the south. So you get liberated through loving Shiva, through bhakti to Shiva. And the various other Shaiva traditions develop, particularly the Lingayats. And there's a wonderful book by Ramanuja called Speaking of Shiva, which you may know, which contains wonderful poetry, devotional poetry to Shiva. Particularly a woman called Mahadevi Yaka, who writes these wonderful... She was an ascetic in South India and who traditionally went naked, which was very unusual for a woman at the time. And she wrote this wonderful poetry to Shiva and rejected worldly attachments. So take these husbands who die, she says, and feed them to your kitchen fires. My only lord is the is my only love is the lord, white as jasmine, which is Shiva. So I'm going to stop because you've got to fill out these forms and they've got to be collected. 5 minutes of questions or any comments.
Can I just ask, yeah. You said that the Ashtapas were the non-cremation ground aesthetics. Where is
the cremation ground aesthetic. Yeah, I forgot all about those, yeah. They're here. These non-cremation, there's a group called Karpalikas. Who are great fun. They cover, the Karpalikas means ones who carry a skull. So they carry a Brahmin skull with which they beg with. And their descendants today are the Aghoris, the Aghori ascetics in Benares. And the Karpalikas carried a staff with a skull on the top, carried a cranium begging bowl, and were adhere to these non-dualist tantras. They courted pollution. They lived in cremation grounds, and they said that liberation comes through the flaunting of Vedic values, through the disruption of Vedic values, that we gain liberation through antisocial behaviour. So they weren't the sort of people that the Shaivists and Hindus would invite to tea. In fact, they were unseeables. So if a Brahmin saw one, he'd have to stare into the sun to purify his eyes. Well, briefly, I think, you know. Yeah, you couldn't, you know. Awesome, I don't know. Anyway, that's what they said. You've had untouchables, these were unseeables for the Shai, but for the Orthodox Brahmins. And they cover themselves not in cremation, not in cow dung ash, but the cremation ground ash from corpses, you know. They're highly polluted and highly polluting. And feared. Now, it gets a bit complicated. The Kashmir Shaivism develops some of their ideas, cleans them up, and makes them, and packages them for the respectable Brahmin householder. But, so they were the polluting ascetics, with the Pashupatas were pure ascetics, the Vedic Vaidika. So next week then I'm going to continue the story with the goddess and also looking at Vaishnava traditions. And I'll stop because you've got to fill out these forms, I'm afraid.